Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Some context in the form of numbers today. $3.4 trillion of income and $6.6 trillion of expenses. That was the federal budget for 2020, which left us with a deficit of $3.1 trillion, just about the amount being discussed as the price tag for President Biden's $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill. These are stratospheric numbers necessary to address tumultuous times, but not unprecedented times. We've been here before, just about 100 years ago. Will we rise to the occasion again? So I've been writing and speaking about this ever since the pandemic started, that we would be and now are facing the most significant economic national challenge since the last pandemic, which basically lasted from 1918 through 1922, and therefore will require as massive a remedy as we saw with the New Deal of the Roosevelt administration. So today we talk infrastructure with Vermont's member of the U.S. House, Congressman Peter Welch. Specifically, we will be discussing the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill being debated in D.C. right now. This bill is about infrastructure for the nation, for Vermont, for our healthcare system, for our schools, and I believe it is absolutely necessary, given the damage that has been done to the nation's infrastructure writ large. We are basically talking about a federal emergency relief act for the new millennium. And I'm thrilled that our own Congressman Welch is joining us today to discuss all these issues.
I love how you call it the new federal emergency relief act, David. And it is. It's what we need to reset our country and start actually addressing the failing systems that are causing harm to so many. I have to say, $3.5 trillion is a very big and a pretty scary number. But what I find scarier is people dying because they can't afford their prescriptions, or the severe weather patterns that we here in Vermont and across the nation have just seen leave so many homes destroyed. The time for action is now, and I'm so grateful that we have Vermont's lone Congressman, Peter Welch, in D.C., reaching across the aisle, building consensus, and advocating for a sustainable future. Last weekend, he was here, meeting with Vermonters to discuss the infrastructure bill and share the impact it will have on the economy and well-being of our country. Today, he's here to share his thoughts with us. So welcome, Congressman Welch.
Congressman, thank you again for taking the time to join us. We're very appreciative of your time, especially now. Let's get right into the discussion of infrastructure. In a Vermont Public Radio interview this past April, you said, "No matter who you voted for, these infrastructure programs are good for society." And right. I agreed with you then, I agree with you now, and I especially agree with a tweet that you sent yesterday highlighting the comparison between the current legislation and Roosevelt's New Deal. I mean, there's no question that the infrastructure package is today's Federal Emergency Relief Act of Roosevelt's time, plus so much more. So Congressman, just as we get started, where are we at this moment, and how can we as Vermonters assist the work that you are doing and the work your colleagues are doing to get this over the line?
Well, I think where we are in the infrastructure is that we're probably going to vote on that by the end of September. And the Senate passed it. It's the $1.1 trillion infrastructure bill. We took a procedural step to move it ahead in the House, but we have to have our final vote on it. And there's some a connection between the infrastructure bill, where there is considerable agreement, and the reconciliation bill, where it's a tooth and nail fight in the House, where we've got basically three votes to spare, and in the Senate, where they have no votes to spare. So, you know, if we're going to be successful with the Biden agenda, which is really the most progressive since LBJ and FDR, then it's really important that we do things that are essential for our infrastructure. And it's really important that we do things that are essential for the well-being of our families. So this is all internal political decisions that have to be made as we go through what is the very difficult process of getting to 218 votes in the House and 50 plus the vice president in the Senate. But I would say that with infrastructure, we're going to get the Senate bill at the end of the day. We had 69 votes. That's the first time we've had a bipartisan vote in the Senate. And of course, President Biden was very much involved in that. So I think that we're going to see that get passed this fall and possibly even this September. So that'll be really good news. It's going to bring considerable resources back to Vermont. And that point you made is the point I'm making with all of the Biden programs. You know, we did a press conference at Quarry Road and Route 14 in Barrie. It's a bad intersection. It's where all the trucks come from the quarries. It's where kids and buses have to turn to go to school. And the point I made, because this infrastructure bill would make that a safer intersection, if your kids are in the back seat, you want them to have a safer ride to school. And that's true whether you voted for Trump or you voted for Biden. And it's really a part of what is so important about the universality of what we're attempting to do with these programs. It's not picking winners and losers. It's picking families and communities and saying, hey, you need childcare. You need safer intersections. You need pre-K. You need to have confidence that your kids can get 2 years of community college without you going broke. So that creates the potential for some unity. And if you notice, there's obviously just incredible partisan fighting in the Congress, much to the dismay of many people, but it reflects the kind of tribal politics of our time. But if you do a survey of people around the country, whether they voted for Trump or they voted for Biden, they want the roads fixed. They want good childcare so that when they go to work, they have confidence that their kids are well taken care of. They don't want their kids to have a mountain of student debt when they get out. So I see this as important in its own right. You know, we do need better roads and bridges, and we do need better childcare, and we do need paid family leave. But what I see as so important is that by talking about things that, in fact, do cut across ideological lines, childcare, good roads, and talking about it concretely, it creates some potential for unity of purpose. And we need more of that, not less of that.
You know, Congressman, I love the phrase unity of purpose. I wrote down a few things that you said. You're absolutely right. And the distillation of this conversation is about not only crafting legislation, but the conversation around what unifies us. And I'm struck with, as a student of history, as you know, the New Deal Congress, the Congress basically from 1933 to 45, was marked in its extraordinarily collaborative approach and process. That's why so much was able to be achieved during that time. Now, and obviously we aren't anywhere near that time in terms of bipartisanship, but what you just said, I think is key to, in some ways, if not achieving, at least beginning to have those collective conversations about moving forward. Because your sentence that you started out with, it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter what side of the aisle on or what you believe, you want your kids to be safe at an intersection, period. Isn't that the way forward?
That's it. Well, I believe it is, because when we're talking about the ideological battles and we're talking about QAnon, we're talking about conspiracy theories, we're not going to persuade anybody who's got a point of view that's different than ours. It just, you know, it's banging your head against the wall. And it almost, that debate, by actually engaging in some of those debates that bear no relationship to there being a better intersection tomorrow than there is today, or more accessible daycare tomorrow than there is today, you're just talking. And you're not even talking about solving a problem that we share. And it's addressing shared challenges that we get outcomes and create unity. You know, it's interesting. I'm in Washington, so these debates are formulaic. It's kind of dispiriting. I get back here, and I'll go back to that intersection in Barrie. There were half a dozen people there, and I have no idea what the politics were of the various people who were there. But they all lived in Barrie. They all cared about Barrie. They all cared about a safer intersection, and they were all working to make that intersection happen. So when you're engaged in something that's real about your life, about the community you live in, you kind of dispense with some of your ideological points of view to get the job done. You know what I mean? And it, all of us get satisfaction when we're doing something and making progress, and that what we're working on actually is bigger than ourselves. So as simple as this example of an intersection is, it's really a metaphor for everyday life, you know, and Vermonters are in the real world, and they have their strong points of view, and they vary from, you know, rabid Trump supporters to rabid Biden supporters. But there's a capacity here still that's starting to elude us in Washington to, all right, let's get real and let's solve the intersection problem. So we need more of that in DC. So what Biden's doing, I think, is really quite important.
I love the analogy. Of course, freedom and unity means do your own thing, but take care of each other, right? Mm-hmm. And to the extent, as Vermonters, when it's negative 20 and you see someone by the side of the road, you don't go up and ask, I'm sorry, what are your thoughts? You help
that's
them.
Right.
That's what we do. And that's what we've always done.
Right. Right. And you take joy in doing that.
And just moving on the, you know, this message of our podcast, and I think one that's dear to you, Congressman Welsh, of like activism and engagement. You know, I'm calling on everyone who's listening to this, write to your congressperson, tell them you want unity of purpose, tell them that these are universal issues for us. Like, let's engage people and let's move it forward in that way, because I love that phrase. But I did want to sort of change the topic from this amazing work that's being done on infrastructure that's so important, and talk a little bit about power, because I think this is also something that you're really feeling is very fragile and very engaged in. And I personally feel like our democracy is under attack. And, you know, for those advocates, people like myself, our power to influence things, like, I'm worried about the systems being implemented to minimize people's voices, like gerrymandering during the current redistricting process, or all of the laws around the country that are restricting access and ease of voting, or even looking at what's happening right now in Texas and with the Supreme Court around women not being able to make their own healthcare decisions. And in many ways, it feels like we're moving backwards. So I'd love for you to talk just a little bit and share some of your thoughts about, like, what can we do to protect our democracy right now? Like this structure that is so amazing. How can we take care of it and ensure that it's going to function in a way that works collaboratively for this unity of purpose and for us all as a country?
Well, first of all, Meg, let me just acknowledge that what you're identifying now is the challenge to our democracy. I actually think that is the existential issue that we face. And, you know, I've been in politics a long time. And here in Vermont, we've been having fights about universal healthcare, Medicare for all. We've been having big fights about the environment and what we can do to protect it. And we always are having debates about taxes and spending. And most of us who got involved in politics at the state or local level, it was about issues that we cared about. But we had a situation where those issues were all being fought out in a context where there were agreed upon norms that voters decided who their president was. And those norms have now been directly assaulted. And it's much more important for us to have confidence in the norms of democracy, that the voters decide who their president is, the peaceful transfer of power, the renunciation of violence as a tool of political persuasion. Unless we restore those norms where they're unquestioned, then our capacity to address these existential challenges we face with the climate with income inequality, with justice for all. It really is diminished. Democracy is a tool for us to work out the differences. And that's why what you're saying is so cogent and compelling. You know, I was there on January 6th. I was in the house when the mob was trying to break the doors down. I was 20 feet away, but a floor above that woman who was shot, and she was actually the leading person coming into the House chamber itself. And that January 6th attack was the first time in the history of our country where the peaceful transfer of power was repudiated, or sought, there was a mob that attempted to overthrow the result of a fair election. Moreover, it's the first time where violence was used as a political tactic to try to achieve that goal, the renunciation of an election. And now, you know, shortly after that happened, you know, it's 3 a.m. when we voted our duty to just certify the election results. I think it was 139 of my colleagues voted no. They voted against that. And that's just never happened. So and the fight goes on. You know, the mob was not successful in overturning the election, but look what's happened since. Most of the Republican candidates for Congress, both new challengers and incumbents, are essentially taking a pledge that the election was stolen. They're siding with the Trump line on that. And that's very dangerous. Moreover, we're seeing in states, just like you mentioned, that they're passing not only voter suppression laws, making it much more difficult for people to vote, but they're really encroaching on the authority of the secretaries of state, who, as in the case of Georgia, you know, a strong Trump supporter, that person stood up for the rule of law and protected the outcome of the vote that Georgian citizens made. And the legislatures in these Trump-led states are trying to set up systems where the elected officials can essentially overrule the election. So this is really dire, really, really dire. And it's a jump ball as to how this is going to turn out. I just want to be sober about this. Okay, I've never seen anything like it, but you're absolutely correct that this is the existential challenge. Now, in the House, we passed H.R. 1, which is about democracy. It's about making voting rights accessible. It's establishing standards. You know, it would limit the capacity of states to basically set up their own legislative review panels, because legislators have no business in deciding what the outcome of an election is. It also starts to attack the incredible problem of huge pockets of deep and dark money in politics that has all exploded since Citizens United was decided. We got that through the House, but that's going to be a tough, tough fight in the Senate, in part because of the filibuster. And with the filibuster, which I think it's time for that to go, it's anti-democratic. It's been used as a means of historically oppressing African-Americans and their struggle for equal justice and rights under the law. So that's the big challenge we face. And I think this is where citizen activism at the local level is incredibly important. And it's got to be state by state. We're fortunate in Vermont because we still have adherence to the democratic process. But in places like Texas, counterparts like A View, people who believe in democracy and face a real threat from this most recent law, they're doing everything they can to restore democratic norms.
Congressman, just that conversation is one that is so profound. And as we all try to wrap this together, it almost seems as though there is an existing opposition or juxtaposition between volume and truth, or between volume and facts, that the individuals who yell the loudest for whatever reason are able to create an agenda that may or may not be based upon fact or truth. And what we've talked about in this podcast and to so many others, and I know with you as well, the embrace, the recommitment to critical thought, to actual analysis, that in many ways, that's also the only answer out of this quagmire, because that's the way to differentiate, to delineate between those very dangerous very loud voices and the truth and fact that, to your point, gets us to focus on the intersection for our kids.
Right. Now, in of course, it's really been magnified, that dynamic you're talking about with social media, okay? Because in the breakdown of credible press outlets, you know, and it's as though everybody has their own source of news. So you go to MSNBC or you go to Fox News, and you can live in an echo chamber where conspiracy theories are reinforced and people believe it. And there's no dialogue and there's no critical theory. And there's a repudiation of science. There's a repudiation of competence and expertise that's dismissed as elitist. And, you know, nowhere have we paid a bigger price because of that than with COVID. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, I was a miracle, the Salk vaccine. You know, I was a boy when polio was still around. There was no discussion about getting the vaccine. I went to school, my arm, you know, stuck my arm out. I didn't like needles. But I mean, I have no recollection of anything other than joy that even at that young age, when I was in grammar school, I could see the relief that my parents had that their kids, we six of us in the family, six kids, we were gonna get vaccinated for that. Now with COVID, where the evidence is absolutely overwhelming that the vaccines are safe and effective, we have lots of folks resisting it. And we have the highest elected officials in states like Florida and Texas who are piling on with bogus attacks on the merits of vaccines. And also are acting as though it's a freedom issue when there are incredible health consequences to innocent people if folks are refusing to get vaccinated for whatever reason, and then become get the illness and spread the illness.
It is almost mind-boggling. I started writing in VT Digger last year, but one thing I never imagined is what you said. I never imagined, nor wrote about, nor could conceive of, that now we would have so many people who didn't do the one thing that could protect us all. That to me was unseeable, unknowable.
We've lost our unity of purpose, as you're calling it, Congressman, so brilliantly. It's that, I think it falls in all of these categories: the infrastructure bill, the attacks on our voting rights, the attacks on our individual beings, and on our society through something like a pandemic. And we have to go so far back to the basics, to this unity of purpose. We're here for each other. We have it in Vermont. Freedom and unity. You take care of your neighbor. You pull someone out of the ditch when the snowstorm grabs them, right? All of these pieces. We've got to bring that spirit around the country. I know you're out there doing it. I love how you talk about these issues. I'm so grateful for your service. I just want to say thank you. And that phrase to me is so powerful, and I hope we can make it go viral on all that social media that does negative stuff. Like, let's get hashtag unity of purpose out there and start rebuilding our country.
Well, Meg, thank you for that. I just want to end by saying that freedom and unity have always, always loved it, because unity requires collaboration. It doesn't promote conflict. You know, sometimes you have conflict, but the goal has to be unified action, because it's in working together that we're successful. So thank you so much for the work you're doing. It's really important you're getting the message out, and I'm really delighted to be a guest on your podcast.
We're thrilled, and thank you for the work you do every day for Vermont and for the nation. And we all, that's exactly right. We will all focus on unity of purpose and a safe intersection for our kids. That's how we move ahead. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you again to Congressman Welsh for that amazing conversation and for tying together our common values and our common hopes and dreams so well as we look towards what we all must do, what we can do, and what we must do in order to build a sustainable, just, healthy future right now and for our children and grandchildren. It was really amazing. What struck you, David?
So Meg, you and I have talked about it, and we certainly, I think the way that you ended that conversation with the congressman, unity of purpose, really, if we were to highlight this particular conversation with the congressman, unity of purpose really defines it, and also defines so much of what we've been trying to talk about in all of these podcasts. I really, as I reflect on it right now, our ability to focus together on that intersection, that metaphorical or actual intersection to keep our families and our kids safe. The intersection of our life, of our roads, of our healthcare system, of our schools, where we all meet. That's the commons, right, Meg? That's the commons, the intersection of the commons. If we are able to focus on that or refocus on that, we move forward. So I'm also deeply grateful for the Congressman's time, and these are the conversations that keep us all going and will move us all ahead.
And as Congressman Welsh said so eloquently, we have to have confidence in the norms of our democracy in order for any of this to work. So really appreciate the conversation. Really appreciate you, our listeners, and would love to know what you're thinking about this conversation, about all of our conversations, or what you'd like to hear us talk about. So feel free to leave a comment wherever you're listening or send us an email with your thoughts to ideas@boldideaspod.com.
And as always, please subscribe to the show wherever you're listening. Follow us on Twitter, hit follow on Spotify, and we'll make sure that you don't miss an episode. We look forward to talking with you next time. Thanks for listening, and remember to think bold.